Good morning and welcome to the October morning panel of the Nebraska Court of Appeals. I am Mike Pirtle from Omaha. I'm pleased to be joined today on my, to my right, Judge Francie Reedman of Gretna, and on my left, Judge Larry Welch of Plattsmouth. We have three cases this morning. We will take them in the order they are listed. I will remind you that this is being streamed live on NET and it will be archived. So if there's anything of a confidential nature, please keep that in mind, and you might want to use first names or something along those lines. So with that, we will begin, and we'll call the first case, State versus Howard.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning, Mr. Wilson. You may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the Court, Counsel for the State. My name is Mike Wilson. I represent John Howard in this appeal from his convictions in the Douglas County District Court. I'm a big fan of the superhero Spider-Man. I grew up a fan of Spider-Man, and I read all the comics, including the very first one. And at the end of that first one, there's a panel where Stan Lee, who's a creative genius, wrote, "With great power comes great responsibility." And in case you think I'm being childish quoting a Spider-Man comic, the U.S. Supreme Court has quoted that. So you wouldn't be the first if you want to quote it as well. We put a lot of trust and power in our prosecutors. We expect that with that power and that trust, they will exercise the responsibility of being truthful in the representations to the juries. We demand that of our prosecutors because juries inherently place a lot of faith in what prosecutors tell them. In this case, the prosecutor did not give an accurate representation to the jury of what was recorded on Exhibit 2. Exhibit 2, a recording of a one-party consent phone call between my client and one of the alleged victims in this case. Now, I trust you've read the briefs. We've raised numerous assignments of error, but if it's okay with the court, I'll focus on that for the moment.
Let's go straight to the closing argument.
Absolutely.
The statements that were made during the closing argument. And more particularly, what objections were made by the defense?
So, the very beginning of the argument, the prosecutor puts on display a visual aid.
Which we don't have.
Which we don't have.
Okay.
And the state's pointed that out. As you know, the defense attorney trial counsel for Mr. Howard read that portion into the record, the portion that we took objection with, or we now take objection with. And the state acknowledged that that's exactly what her visual aid said and defended her right to put that before the jury, that Mr. Howard admitted the penetration element of the sexual assault offenses, particularly the ones, and then she went on to argue that he admitted inserting his finger into the vaginas of the alleged victims.
My understanding in reading the record is that the objection that was made in a sidebar with the court, and the objection was to the display of the graphic.
Well, the objection was to the graphic and to that, what was in there, absolutely.
And then there was no further objection.
Now, when you, absolutely, not during the argument, right.
Now, when even after the argument.
Correct. We've raised as ineffective assistance
right.
Trial counsel's failure to re-raise it throughout the argument, or at least at the end to argue that there should be a mistrial, something more.
So where are we? Was it ineffective assistance to failure to raise it, or is it error on the court?
It's error on the court, Your Honor. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
That's right. Go ahead.
It's error on the court, Your Honor. Alternatively, it's ineffective assistance of trial counsel. And I did that very purposely, because I saw what you're seeing. And I wanted to make sure the court had an opportunity to correct this now. So I wanted to bring it as both error by the trial court and ineffective assistance of counsel. I don't think I could do much more than that. I needed to get it before the court now because this was a grave, grievous error. You know, we trust that when you listen to Exhibit 2, and we know you will hear what we heard which is an unequivocal denial of penetration. He says quite clearly, and I sat there and transcribed this. I never do that. I don't sit and listen to recordings and transcribe them. It's an unofficial transcription, but I wanted to give you our take on what he says, and you can play it and read it along with the recording. He says very clearly in there, it wasn't in you. I didn't put anything in you.
That's not how I remember it, I believe is his language.
So,
not how I remember it.
Right.
And then it was just consistently, I washed you the way your mother taught me.
Correct. And there's one description of those cleaning instructions. And in that description of those cleaning instructions, he says unequivocally, it wasn't in you. That, I can only state, is, you know, that is not an admission. Clearly not an admission. And when you read the prosecutor's argument over and over and over, she says, he told MH during the phone call that he was sorry for cleaning you the way, cleaning her the way the mother showed him to clean her. Now, and then she says in that same breath, that's ridiculous. Her mother didn't show Mr. Howard, didn't tell Mr. Howard to put his fingers in her vagina. That's nonsense. So in other words, she's representing to the jury that he was defending himself with the nonsense defense that I was putting my fingers in your vagina because your mother showed me to do that. That is an argument that he admitted. That is a representation that he admitted penetration on that phone call. And that was a misrepresentation of what was said on the phone call. That is the crux of our argument on that.
And if I recall, the defense countered that during their closing argument as well.
I believe the defense made an argument countering that, and, you know, if you look at Beter, that's a case that I cited because in the closing arguments, the prosecutor wrongly represented to the jury that the defendant admitted certain things, admitted a full offense, essentially, and isn't offering a defense. The defense objected there. There was an admonition given, and the Supreme Court still reversed all the convictions. That's because a prosecutor saying wrongly that a defendant admitted an offense is just so damaging to a defendant that how on earth is he supposed to return, you know, to unring that bell, to get the jury back to square one and really evaluate what happened here. Maybe that could have happened, for instance, had the court allowed them to rehear exhibit number 2 as they wanted to and as defense counsel requested. But again, the trial judge sided with the prosecutor and said, no, you're not going to get that opportunity. And so they were left with their memory of something that they heard days earlier one time and then repeated hammering away by the prosecutor in closing argument stating that on that recording he admitted. If it's okay, Your Honors, I might reserve 2.5 minutes for rebuttal.
Just a quick question before
sure.
We go. The graphic that you're talking about, you said it was read into the record because we don't have it otherwise. When was it read into the record?
At the time trial counsel objected. I can, when I come back up, Your Honor, I'll provide you a cite.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Good morning, Ms. Klein.
Good morning. May it please the Court, I'm Kimberly Klein, Assistant Attorney General, representing the state in this matter. Your Honors, every party in closing argument is entitled to make an argument based on a rational interpretation of the facts as they presented themselves at trial, and what the state's closing argument was exactly that. The state didn't ever say to the jury, he admits that he inserted his fingers into her vagina. What the state said is he never denied it, and that is precisely rationally based on Exhibit 2. As you look at Exhibit 2, which is the one-party consent tape, the victim spends quite a bit of time talking to her father about the events and repeatedly asks him, you know, I need you for my basically my mental health, I need you to admit and to apologize for what you did. And ultimately, at about 15 minutes and 42 seconds into the tape, she asks him if he could apologize for touching her in the way she was saying that he did. And he finally said, yeah, okay, I apologize. And, of course, he always, whenever he walks up to the line of saying that he did something wrong, he falls back on his mantra that he was just following orders and baiting her the way that he was allegedly instructed to. About 16 minutes and 23 seconds into that conversation, the victim again asks him to take responsibility, and I think that's a key phrase, take responsibility, and she would like an apology, and he says, okay, I apologize, I take full responsibility, and she says, for touching me, and he says, yes. So I think the state's argument and closing argument was entirely rational.
Well, touching me is different. That's sexual contact. We're talking sexual penetration. And the statement in closing arguments, you heard the call. M.H. repeatedly tells him, you put your finger inside of me during bath time. He never once denies that. He repeatedly says, that's not how I recall it.
He does say that's not how I recall it, and then later on, again, he starts essentially waffling, if you will, on the statements. Part of the convictions were not all based on sexual penetration. There was one of them was, I think, sexual assault of a child, which only requires sexual contact. Mm-hmm. So the argument for this, for what the state was saying, clearly goes to that charge. The sexual penetration, he never directly says, yes, I did that. There's no question about that. He'd have been a moron if he did, and I don't think anyone ever really expected him to. But because he's saying that I take responsibility for touching you inappropriately, and the rest of the evidence, particularly when coupled with MH's testimony about what had happened, I think the state was entitled to argue that he never actually completely denies that he penetrated her. If he had denied penetrating her, that's fine. The jury heard the evidence, what it was. They were also instructed that the arguments of the attorneys are not evidence. And
but we do hold our prosecutors to a pretty high standard, not to misrepresent. And as a result, juries tend to rely upon statements that they make, even though they're instructed it's not evidence.
Well,
and as far as the jury remembering and having heard, they obviously didn't remember. They wanted to hear it again, and the court denied them that. So when the last words heard from them are the closing arguments of the prosecutor, if it does in fact misrepresent the evidence, where does that leave us?
Well, I think then you need to determine just how, I guess, how misleading it was. If it's a direct contradiction of the evidence, which it may or may not have been, if it's a direct contradiction of the evidence, then I think, again, the jury heard what the jury heard. The evidence is what the evidence is. And the jury may have wanted to rehear the whole entire tape-recorded conversation. We don't really know why. It may have been for whether or not he admitted it. It may have been for something else entirely. But the court said, well, you know, no, I'm not going to allow that. And I think that was out of an abundance of caution, because the judge, under these circumstances, has broad discretion to allow or not allow them to rehear the tape recorded conversation. And I think based on kind of reading between the lines, I think the court was concerned that the jury would place undue emphasis on that particular recording, and has been an expressed concern of the Supreme Court and of this court with respect to these particular types of, you know, recorded conversations. They don't want to unduly emphasize one particular part of the evidence over another. You have to look at the case as a whole, as an entire, I guess, entity, and determine from all the evidence adduced whether or not the state has proved its case. And I think that's why the district court refused to let them rehear Exhibit 2. If every time they asked to rehear something, they had, I guess, a a right or a presumption that they were able to do so. I think trials would take a lot longer, among other things. But I think, excuse me, as you look at the evidence as a whole, the state's argument was mostly rationally based on the evidence that was presented to the district court, or to the jury in this particular case. And the defendant, in fact, apologized to the victim for his actions previously. And I think based on that, I think the jury was entitled to believe MH's testimony that the events had in fact happened, whether or not the defendant denied it. And because her testimony was essentially unequivocal, that did indeed happen. And the tape-recorded conversation was, sort of secondary, supporting evidence of her testimony with respect to those events.
It's the only evidence, it's the only direct evidence, the only statements of the defendant that the jury actually heard, right? He didn't testify.
Correct. So essentially, Exhibit 2 was corroborative of or supportive of the victim's testimony that this did in fact happen. And the victim's direct testimony was, yes, it did indeed happen, and I can give you, and she gave some fairly remarkable detail about the events when these particular things happened.
Was it ineffective assistance of counsel for appellant's trial counsel not to object to the statements made by the prosecutor during closing and then also move for a mistrial?
I think at this point, I don't know that I would. I would say no, because I don't think those objections would have been sustained at that point. The defense got up and made essentially a, if you will, corrective argument, or at least gave their rebuttal version of what the evidence showed in this particular case. And I don't think that the objections, had they been made, or the motion for mistrial, had it been made, would have been sustained at that point. So I don't think it would be ineffective assistance of counsel. And basically, I'm going on the prejudice prong, just because it's easier to resolve it on that.
The defendant was convicted of first-degree sexual assault of a child, and first-degree sexual assault of a child. Are the first-degree sexual assaults SH only, and then the sexual assault of MH, or do we not know?
I'm not sure we know. I'd have to go back and look at the record, Your Honor. I apologize. I don't know that right off the top of my head. Your Honors, unless there are additional questions, we would ask that the judgment of the district court be affirmed.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
How much time for rebuttal do we have?
2 minutes.
Okay. All right. Mr. Wilson.
Thank you, Your Honors. Your Honor, page 812 is your citation for that. The two portions of the record the state just mentioned, I believe, are out of context. I believe that when Howard says, I apologize, she says, do you apologize for touching me in the way that I'm saying you did? Can you just apologize? He says, you know, I apologize. For intentionally touching me? MH says, Howard says, I apologize for cleaning you the way your mom told me. She gets upset, yells, Dad. She's mad because he's not providing the confession that she's trying to get out of him. Okay, if you go to the next one, she quotes the state, counsel for the state. Can you just take MH, look, is this just this one thing? This is the only thing I want to talk about right now, okay? Can you just take responsibility for what you did, and I would like an apology. Howard says, okay, I apologize. I take full responsibility. MH says, for touching me? Howard, yes. Yes? MH says, thank you. Howard says, well, to clean. And then MH says, no, you went beyond that. And then she interrupts Howard, and Howard finishes what he's saying, as what I was told. So again, every single one of these instances, he keeps referring back to these cleaning instructions, which he describes as not including penetration. That is key. That is key. And for the state to go into closing argument and represent to the jury and to the judge that what's on that recording is his failures to deny and admissions is a misrepresentation of what is on that disc.
Point of query. Go ahead.
Well, is penetration required for the sexual assault of a child?
It depends on the degree. First-degree sexual assault it is.
Well, he's got two first degrees and one sexual assault.
My understanding, if you go back to the information, I know you asked other counsel that I believe that MH is the subject of count one first-degree sexual assault of a child. That's my understanding. Obviously, that's in the record. The court can clarify that. But I'm fairly certain that she was the subject.
Point of clarity, the state just argued that the closing argument didn't involve an admission as such as much as not denying it. Would you agree with that? Was it that the state was, or was it that the argument was they denied it, or was the argument that he never denied it?
All right, so I see what you're saying. The state brought some of that up in its brief. It tried to draw a contrast between failure to deny and admit.
Exactly.
And what I point out in my reply brief, Your Honor, and I'll repeat here, is that if you look at the state's argument at trial, it was that he admitted, by the theme of the argument, was he admitted by failing to deny and by direct admission, both. He did both, according to the state's arguments, oral and visual presentation. And it's peppered throughout. He never denied it. He never denied it. She says that so many times during the closing argument. Then she spins that into, he says that he might have penetrated, he admits penetrating her, but he claims that he did it because his wife told him to do it that way. That's nonsense. So the prosecutor does both in her closing argument. She says he admits by citing cleaning instructions that include penetration, when in the exhibit he clearly denies that they include penetration. And she says that he admits by failing to deny. Okay. And you can make that argument if it's true. You know, if it's true that he never denied it, but it's not true. He denies it multiple times, as I said, throughout that call. And it's on the disc. It's on the disc. That's the beauty. Most of the time, the facts are not in my favor as an appellant's attorney on a criminal case. I've got a disc. So there's no, your honors can listen to it and you can, you know, make a decision. I hope it's the right one, judges. Thank you. All right.
How far did we take him over? You want any more time, Ms. Klein?
No.
All right. Thank you. Case is submitted. We'll take it under